Thank you for being here. Sarah Cross has been in second in her series of Music and War, and today is going to focus on World War II. Thank you, Sarah.
Well, thank you. Thanks for coming. And I want to say before I launch into everything that I'm indebted to a scholar named Annegret Bowser, who has written books on music and war in World War II, and is a leading expert on that. I'm drawing on her writing from the book that I edited, Music and War in the United States. I'm especially using chapters 9 and 10. Today, on Monday when we covered the Civil War, I was looking at chapters 4 and 5. So, and just a very quick infomercial, these books are for sale in paperback in the bookstore, and I'll be doing a book signing from 3 to 4. So no pressure, I'm just announcing. I'm not doing this whole promotion thing. So, World War II.
Is your mic on?
So just a quick music overview of this era. Starting in 1939, jukeboxes were on the scene. Radio, of course, was everywhere. It had been very popular in the 30s, and so the role of technology in promoting and spreading music is vital, especially since we're going to be focusing on propaganda today and how music was broadcast to different audiences with different goals. There was a radio show called Your Hit Parade, which was featured particularly popular songs like more groups like the Andrews Sisters and Bing Crosby and lots of big band music. In the Mood was released in 1939, and Frank Sinatra made his debut that year in 1940 with Tommy Dorsey's band, I'll Never Smile Again. Even though the song was interrupted by some kind of silly dialogue, it was from a film, that was his first major appearance. 1940, cowboy musicals were popular. Some of you might have seen Gene Autry, the singing cowboy, right? Deep in the Heart of Texas, of course, right? Glenn Miller and his band played things like Chattanooga Choo Choo, and so Western music was kind of new. Broadway was flourishing. George and Ira Gershwin collaborated, of course. Rodgers and Hart, and Kurt Weill, who was a refugee from Nazi Germany, of course, was writing musicals as well. 1941, of course, is the day everybody remembers, December 7th, the bombing of Pearl Harbor. And so with that, the United States basically emerged out of the Depression and entered the arena, the global arena of World War II. And so we're going to talk about some of those things. And I'll play a song, I think, first, that was written in response to the bombing, which came out right after that happened. And with the note that, unfortunately, wartime is good for musicians, in the sense that it creates opportunities to write and to compose and perform. And that was true in the Civil War as well, when we saw the explosion of sheet music coming out of places like Chicago and New York and Detroit, and it's still true. So a lot of popular songs that we still know today were written during the war and were spurred by events that happened there. So if I can get the right track here, the song I want to play is Praise the Lord and Pass the Ammunition. Yes. You all know that? By Kay Kaiser.
Shall we praise the Lord? We're on the mighty mission. Oh, the Lord, we ain't the competition. Praise the Lord and pass the ammunition, and we'll all stay free.
It just sounds so naive, but this is what happens generally at the beginning of wars. Everybody's positive. Remember World War I? This war will be over by Christmas. Started in August. Well, 4 years later, still going on. So this was one of the responses to the bombing of Pearl Harbor. The rhymes are terrible, but but it was jaunty, and it got people kind of fired, and also actually helped spread the word, because at that point, radio was the only nationwide form of media that people would hear, whether they were in the countryside in Alabama or New York City or someplace else. Yeah, Chris?
So, Sarah, you said that the wartime is an opportunity for musicians to compose and whatnot. and yes, for World War II, but it seems to me, especially Vietnam, it was anti-war. Are there examples of positive war songs from the Vietnam era, or even 9/11, or was that true in the past, but not necessarily so in the present or future?
Well, times were very different then, yes, in Vietnam, and I don't want to go down that rabbit hole right now.
Okay.
World War II, I don't know of protest songs for World War II, because my sense is that it was a very clear-cut idea for most people.
Correct.
Right? And rally, yeah. And the draft started back up in 1940, I think. And so, you know, whether you supported the war or not, you had to go if you were a male in that age frame. So there are songs that emerge that are complaining. I've got one song, The Soldiers, where the soldiers change the words. And there's sometimes, what we'll see later, is the discrepancy between what the soldiers actually experienced in combat and their emotions and their feelings with the idea of war at home and the civilians. There's always that gap. But I wanted to keep going with this. So basically a spirit of can-do positivism, of course, right? And so that was one song anyway. There are others, of course, and I guess what I want to focus on really is the kind of, what was different about this war than earlier ones was how the government, the U.S. government, took control over the dissemination of propaganda. It deemed it was important enough to get involved, to organize. The Department of Defense created different levels of things. And the main one was the Office of War Information, the OWI. And that's something that hadn't happened in any of the previous wars, including World War I, okay? So the Office of War Information was established in 1941 to organize a response, both spoken and written, but then eventually with music as well, to the Axis powers. And I want to show you some of the things that led up to that, and I've got some pictures as well. Okay, this is a picture of, this is one of the things that happened when the war started, and men started being called up. Women's bands and orchestras were formed. So in that sense, women also had more opportunities than they might have had before. This is the Marine Corps Women's Reserve Band from 1943. And every branch of the service had their women's service band. They were reserves. Obviously, they didn't go overseas, but they played at home. They played patriotic music. They rallied, played concerts, and they toured. And you can see women playing instruments that women had been discouraged from playing. I mean, there are female tuba players here.
Yeah.
Right? And that has not ever really been considered a woman's instrument. And of course, the whole idea of military bands came out of the Civil War. After the Civil War ended, bands were still popular, and every town, every small town had their city band. Some of them were better than others, but they played concerts, especially in the summer, they played for holidays, and they marched, and so that tradition was really well established by this time. So these women picked up, and I don't know their ages, I don't know their training, but they had learned, there's an awful lot of clarinet players, so you're not going to have the standard instrumentation of probably the Marine Corps band or an Army band, but still a big enough group with enough variety of instruments that you could hear. Here's some serious repertoire. This is a picture of Corporal Dai Kyung Lee, who you can tell by his name was, he's American, but he was also part Korean, composing a symphonic poem while deployed in the Pacific. This is a photo that the government used to show how inclusive we were.
Yeah.
Right? Okay. And of course, because we've got the indigenous people on either side, I'm not sure where he was, if he was in the Philippines or New Guinea or wherever it was, but showing how a couple of messages here. One was that Americans could compose classical music. This was something the Nazis had used against us. That we were a barbarian nation. We hadn't produced any great composers like Beethoven or Schumann or Brahms, you know, all the Germans, of course. That all we had was popular music and jazz, which was, because of its racial connections, considered degenerate. So here's a photo of a serious musician composing a symphonic piece for orchestra, which is still considered the highest, most classical, highbrow genre. And maybe this person on the left here is learning from him. So the idea is that he would be using maybe some indigenous melody in his piece, thereby combining East and West a little bit. And this is Bess Womack's Hawes. So when the government decided the OWI was formed in 1941, it was basically consisted of men directing it, but they concentrated on written literature and repertoire, and they decided there were two focuses of this office. One was a domestic audience and one was overseas. They were going to focus their efforts on those two areas. And they made some really silly blunders. For example, they broadcast the tune Finlandia to Russian troops. Our Soviet, right, because they were allies, the USSR was our ally, but they were in the process of trying to invade Finland, and Finland was fighting back.
Yeah.
You know, so not good. And so Bess Lomax, as you can tell by her name, was related to the Lomax brothers, the folk song collectors who traveled through the US the first half of the century. And she was an active folk song writer and singer. She was connected with Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger. And she was hired to be acting director of the musical division of the OWI. She was technically the assistant, but there was such a turnover in the early years that she ended up being the acting director, and yet she never got credit for it because she was a woman, yeah. But under her leadership, she organized the overseas branch's record library. And by the end of 1942, that consisted of 50,000 items, sound items that could be used. They were used in broadcasts in the US. There were two main offices, one in New York, one in Washington, D.C. The New York office was the one that mainly broadcast overseas, I think, because of location. Washington was centered on the domestic audience. By early 1945, there were over 200,000 records in this library. And they were initially, of course, you know, the old 78s, right, were made out of shellac. But then that was rationed during the war. So plastic was beginning to be used in World War II, which I didn't know. But anyway, she oversaw this and was very effective in maintaining continuity when there was all this change of leadership. And I think I had a quote from her. So what kind of music did they play? Well, it was these records encompassed everything. Classical music, folk songs, patriotic music, religious music. And we can consider this almost like, the OWI thought of this as kind of a weapon of war, music as a weapon. And I forgot, I wanted to back up. The word propaganda itself has an interesting etymology. It comes from Propagandio Defide, which is the Catholic Church came up with this in 1622 as part of the Counter-Reformation. Congregations for the Propagation of the Faith. Right? So they were pushing back against Protestantism in the 17th century, and you can see this, especially the Counter-Reformation in Italy. So many paintings created to glorify the Catholic faith and religion. And music as well was written for that. So that idea of manipulating people's emotions, appealing to people's emotions and not as much their rational side, is really the basis of propaganda, right? So if you're thinking about it and listening to things, you have to turn on that part of your brain that analyzes, like, what is this really saying? And we're all subject to it. I mean, you could call some kinds of advertising propaganda. Right? They're trying to appeal to your emotions, to your insecurity, to your doubts, to your patriotism in many cases. And that's what was going on here in World War II, on both sides, both the Allies and the Axis. So music was part of that. And I think you can see why, because music, of course, appeals to your emotions many times. Whether it's vocal music or just instrumental music, composers who are skilled at orchestration know exactly how to do that. Certain intervals, cause certain reactions, certain keys, certain textures. If you hear strings, right, that tends to be a little softer, more mellow sound. It can also be very angry. But, you know, woodwind instruments have their different colors. And so the recordings they collected were just a whole variety of things that would fit any occasion, I guess you might say.
Were there that many new songs, or did they save every variation of it?
They just collected all kinds of performances, recordings, yeah. No, there weren't that many new things.
Yeah.
In 19, a point of view from the other side, Joseph Goebbels, of course, was the chief head of propaganda for the Nazis. And he wrote, before the war, "The propagandist must be the man with the greatest knowledge of souls. I cannot convince a single person of the necessity of something unless I get to know the soul of that person, unless I understand how to pluck the string in the harp of his soul that must be made to sound." So interesting that he uses a music metaphor as part of that, right?
Excuse me, were those collected songs like approved songs, or would people had to play them on the radio, or were they just...
That's a good question. I don't know about how the programming worked. I don't know how much control the OWI had over individual stations, because this is the era before any consolidation of things. There were just thousands and thousands of radio stations across the U.S., so I don't think so. But of course, you know, the certain atmosphere takes over, and you want to be support your troops, you want to boost morale, so you probably would play upbeat things more than anything else, and positive classical music. Let's see. And some of the musicians who were associated with this project, who served as advisors, were the leading classical composers in the United States at the time. So you have Samuel Barber, Elliot Carter, Henry Cowell, Aaron Copland, who in 1943 wrote Fanfare for the Common Man, and also Abraham Lincoln Portrait, Virgil Thompson, and Kurt Weill, who, as I said, is an emigre. But this was a big-time effort. These people were all very prominent and were involved in this. So the Army decided, a singing army is a winning army, right? That was a quote from a captain, Captain Joe Jordan, in 1943. And this echoes exactly what people were saying in the Civil War. Remember Robert Lee saying, "I don't believe we can have an army without music." That has a couple of meanings, but the idea that singing was the best way to get men to bond together, to keep morale high, and to get everybody on the same page in terms of what the mission was, what our goal was. So the Army decided to issue these songbooks. And I believe that there were mandatory song sessions in the training camps, right? And this picture is interesting, because if you start looking at it, you can pick out some people, right? Mm-hmm. Which American figures do you see in this? Yeah, Lincoln probably with the stovepipe hat, right?
Paul Revere.
Yeah.
Paul Revere.
David
Crockett. Yeah. But then George Washington, yes, with the tri-point hat.
Oh yeah, that's George Washington.
I don't think there's...
Down below, I guess.
I should use a blazer. Who is this? Looks like he's an admiral. Like a...
John Paul Jones.
Yeah, John Paul Jones. Maybe David Farragut.
Ferry.
Yeah, could be. This guy with the hat and the mustache.
Buffalo Bill.
Yeah, Buffalo Bill. And this one. Do you recognize the hat? You can't see his glasses. Teddy Roosevelt, the Rough Riders. Right? Spanish-American War.
Wow.
I don't know who this person in the middle is. I guess this is kind of a generic general. He has stripes. And I'm not sure who this is either.
Pershing? The collar that's right for World War I.
This, you mean? Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, that's the mystery. But, and then, of course, you got your Union soldier up here from the Civil War. So, little visual propaganda, right? Like, this is the tradition you're drawing on.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the Cupid is like. Providing some kind of divine inspiration.
He's directing, isn't he?
The views.
That's important.
Well, it looks like Lincoln's the one who's directing. Yes, and of course they're all modeling great vocal production with the mouse full open, right?
Yeah.
Because that's how you sing.
And there they are.
And here's the songbook in use.
They're looking up.
That's totally realistic, right?
Yeah.
And I think the guy on the right bears a striking resemblance to Groucho Marx.
Yes.
But the odd thing is they're singing, but they're not looking at the book at all.
Right. I think it's a staged picture.
You think so?
They're looking for that cherub.
Yeah, right.
And now I don't know, but obviously the one on the right is in uniform, and the one in the left, I don't know exactly why he's dressed that way, if that's another message. These are supposed to be just ordinary Joes, G.I. Joe, right?
Mm-hmm.
Singing.
That's a uniform shirt.
They're both in uniform.
They're both in
yeah,
uniform.
Okay. So this photo was also, of course, sent out. It was published. Our singing soldiers. The Army Songbook included a whole variety of things. Folk songs, camp songs, old-timey songs like Stephen Foster, right? They probably didn't put Home Sweet Home in. That's not good because it would make soldiers homesick. But those kind of things that they would, you grew up learning in school, what they called school songs, right? So then that was fine, but then it was, soldiers wanted more popular things, you know? These were young guys. These were anywhere from 18 to 25. They didn't want to sing old-time songs all the time. They certainly didn't want to always sing patriotic songs. So the Army came up with a new line called Hit Kits, beginning in 1943. And these were published monthly, kind of like magazines. They also contained, besides the standard, you know, like more popular songs, like maybe a Broadway tune, for example, right? Those would be popular. They also contained favorite songs of our allies, is what a publication said, with a triple text underlay. So there would be English, the original language, and then a phonetic transliteration. And this was a very kind of clever move to broaden the propaganda to include, we're all fighting the Axis together. So they would have a French folk song, for example, right? Or a Russian song with the transliteration. Now, I don't know how successful that was, or how many people sang those, but it was an attempt, anyway, to be inclusive. The purpose was to stimulate group singing, keep soldiers with what is being sung at home. So there's a morale thing here, but also that connection that the loved ones at home wanted to have with their soldiers and vice versa, right? Of course, that's all part of keeping your morale up. And that somebody got the great idea of putting these in the mailboxes, like mail call, once a month. So even if a soldier didn't get any other mail, he got this. There was something in his box. Thousands, millions of these things printed up. And then 4 months later, the government started issuing these V-discs, which were all kinds of music on 12-inch plastic discs. And they included current and favorite songs, the most popular dance bands, of course, because swing was still very popular, right? Big bands. Symphonic, semi-classical, sacred, and patriotic music. And they were shipped out in groups of 20 records plus 200 needles. I don't know what the records should destroy the needles, or if they just got, you know, they were casualties of war as well. But
needles were usually made out of steel to hold up as well as ones they made later. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's good. I didn't think about the material. They certainly weren't diamond tip. Mm-hmm. So between 1943, when these were launched, and 45. There were over 3 million of these V-discs produced and shipped around the world. Hmm. As far away as the South Pacific. And soldiers would write letters and say, could you please send us more of fill in the blank. There was one letter I remember reading from a soldier who said, We really liked Brahms Symphony No. 3. Could you send us more recordings of that? We've worn out the one we have. I kind of wonder if his CEO didn't put him up to that.
Good German music.
Yeah, good German music, right? There's also another story of how it was in the Navy. It was a destroyer or something. It wasn't a submarine, but the captain forced, he was determined to educate his men, to uplift them, because a lot of the soldiers came from very rural, very impoverished backgrounds or backwoods, you know, I mean, they didn't know, they'd never heard classical music before. He was determined to improve them by playing the same recording over and over of Beethoven's Sixth Symphony. Okay. And they hated it at first, but because I had no choice and there was nothing else to listen to, they supposedly learned to like it, and then they wanted more. That's the official line. So it's interesting the uses that these things were put to. But again, these were a lifeline for the soldiers who were stationed far away when they were not in combat zones. And that gets back to what we talked about with the Civil War, in that there was downtime. And what people weren't fighting all the time. There were many times when they were stationed somewhere, or maybe after a battle when some territory had been reclaimed, and they were stuck there for a long time. Especially in the South Pacific, when those islands were taken back from the Japanese, that I'm sure they felt very isolated. They're so far away from home. Okay, let's see. So these were all done with under the auspices of the OWI. And it was very well organized. And also, one other thing that I said about composers being helped by this situation is that there were serious classical works commissioned by the government for the VDES. Roy Harris wrote a symphony. An African-American composer, William Grant Still, composed a symphony, and that was one of the first major works by an African-American composer to be published and to be performed and recorded. So there were important things. Aaron Copland, of course, as I mentioned. There's another composer whose name I'm forgetting at the moment who wrote a folk song symphony. So you know they were using material that they thought would resonate with the troops. And classical music, again, not just as an educational tool, but to prove to any Nazis or any Axis people who were listening that we could provide that music. We could play, we could compose classical music. We weren't inferior in that sense. So, some quotes here. This is what Eleanor Roosevelt said in support of this idea as music for morale and for propaganda. At all times, music should be part of our lives, and I think in times of strain, such as this present period, it is more valuable than ever. Music is one of the finest flowerings of that free civilization which has come down to us from our liberty-loving forefathers, and we have come to regard it as an essential of the heritage of a country that has cherished the genius of the great composers and the musical artists of all lands and people. Music is a force for morale, and contributes to the happiness and well-being of the millions who turn to it for enjoyment, relaxation, consolation, and spiritual renewal. It should go on fulfilling its mission. That was written 2 months after Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. And I think we all know that, you know, Eleanor Roosevelt had great influence on culture and morale, and was a very articulate advocate of these things. Any questions or comments so far? I think let's talk about the holding prayer. Do you want to say something about that?
Yeah, I was just pointing out to Sarah earlier that the prayer allowed for the holding prayer, O God, you called your servant to mention, which we cannot see the ending, but has the head untrodden, your barrels unknown, which is used very widely these days. It started out here from Holden in 1963. It was written during World War II and published in 1941 in a book called Daily Prayer in England. And then when Pearl Harbor happened and we went to war with the Japanese, there were many people, not just Lutherans, but Anglicans and others, who were training in the Philippines to learn Chinese to be missionaries in China. And the first directors of Holden, Carol and Mary Peterly, were in China learning Chinese, and they were imprisoned by the Japanese for about 4 years. in a place called Baguio in the Philippines. And included in that group were some Anglican missionaries. And we're still piecing this together. I'm sort of working on this history of prayer, that because they were all together there and the Anglicans had either had the book or they knew the prayer. That was how Carol, a Hindu especially, learned the prayer and knew it. And prayer, it's a very comforting prayer. And what about good courage and all of those things. So when he became a director here in 1963, happily, the service book in Hebrew, which was published in 1958, included that prayer in the prayer section, prayer 96 on page 231. That's what Carol did. I mean, he said at worship and he'd go, we're not going to pray prayer 96 on page 231. And that's what we did. So this prayer that was both born in World War II and then also learned out of the great suffering that people in World War II made its way to Holden Village as just as this ongoing support and foundational prayer for everyone who's been through this place. So it's just an interesting little piece. You can come in more about it tomorrow at 10:15 in the Shalei Tzuba.
I knew that, Carol.
Yeah,
Carol Hinderle.
Yeah.
Yes.
Usually, you know, as a retired pastor, I try to put things into some type of historical context. So when he's coming here in 1963, that's only 18 years after the end of the war.
Yeah, it is.
18 years ago was 2001. I mean, I think it's helpful for us to keep those time frames in mind. It's not that big of a leap from 1945 to 1963. And with something, an experience like that, it's indelible. It's just indelible. And we are the heirs to that.
Yeah, and I hope at the end of this, we should have to well make time for you all to discuss things, because I think, as I said to somebody yesterday, we all still have connections with living survivors of the war, people who fought. The number dwindles daily, but there's still people out there. You all have, I'm sure, family, relatives, ancestors, you know, somebody that you know or you've heard of who fought in the war, who was involved in it, plus stories of domestic life and that kind of thing. So I have some questions about how we remember things, and we'll talk about that later. So let's, the things we just talked about, the V-discs, the song, Army songbooks, and the hit kits, were all aimed at, really at the soldiers first and foremost, but also the other larger audiences, because government was fully aware that there were people in Britain who wanted to hear music, and jazz, of course, was an incredibly effective tool, because coming out of the 30s, the big band era, people all over Europe loved American jazz. I'll talk about what the Nazis tried to do with that. It kind of backfired on them. But anyway, so that was kind of the official high-minded approach to sending music as propaganda. Now, there were other things that were, propaganda is also used negatively, of course, and one of the things that it does is demonize enemies, reduce them to caricatures, if not just plain evil, so that you can fight them and kill them without any fear of having committed a mortal sin. So Spike Jones wrote a song, and Disney got involved in this, and this also brings us to the idea of film as a technology, which hadn't existed in a prior conflict, or at least not in a very sophisticated way, right? There is film footage of World War I, but it's very old, very jerky, and it's worth looking at. But it had grown and matured drastically by 1941. So film enhances, it's another avenue for spreading propaganda, through films with background music and also songs. And the Disney family came up with some animated things. I can't show them because I'd have to stream it. But they made a classic short called Donald Duck in Nutsy Land. Mm-hmm. And maybe you've seen that. You can get this on YouTube. You can check it out. They also had Bugs Bunny Nips the Nips. So very racist.
Yeah.
Right? And Disney also subsidized the production of this movie, a short called Education for Death. And it uses music of Wagner, right? And symbolism and how from the infancy, children in Germany were being brainwashed to be Nazis, to kill, and to be fascists. And so those things were shown, as I understand it, in theaters. Like, you know, they always had newsreels. These shorts were shown in a theater before the feature film started. And so they were widely viewed across the United States. Now I have, there's a recording of Spike Jonze. Does that name sound familiar?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, Der Führer's face.
Oh, yeah.
I think my mom had some old 78s by him. That's not it. Sounds like a polka band, right? Your girl playing out because Spike Jonze had his own band and things.
How about Disney? He was independent too.
Yeah, and of course Disney had already been making animated features, right? Mickey Mouse. I don't know when Mickey Mouse was born, but it was earlier, late 20s maybe. Yeah. So the Disney Studios were well established, and so they came out with this. But there's a visual equivalent that goes with this that you can see if you look at YouTube, and it's got the worst racist caricatures you can imagine. You know, you've got, who was the Emperor Hirohito, right? But who was, I don't know, remember the general's name, the Japanese?
Tojo.
Yeah. It's got the, everything that you just, all the negative things, and it's got Mussolini, you know, huge belly, you know, big mustache and everything. So they're all in that, and there's a lot of visual stuff going on besides the song. But that's an example of how propaganda was sent to the public, and there was friendly propaganda and not so friendly propaganda, right? One thing, another aspect of what the U.S. did, of course, was to broadcast music into occupied countries, mm-hmm. and they had underground radio stations, pirate radio stations, there's all kinds of things going on with that, and I myself don't know enough about it, but I know that Glenn Miller was involved in something called the Wehrmacht Hour, where they broadcast from England into occupied France, into Germany, because the truth was the German young people, the German pilots, the Luftwaffe pilots, loved jazz. And so, you know, the German government, there wasn't an official ban on it, but they certainly weren't allowing it to be played on their radio stations. But we could broadcast with enough strength, airwaves through to other countries. And so those things were going on. And I didn't bring the CD, but there's a CD of recording of Glenn Miller speaking very bad German with his translator, who then kind of smooths it out and says, "And now we're bringing you, Glenn Miller's band playing." And Miller, of course, was known for smooth jazz, right? Sweet jazz. And so then they went ahead and broadcast. So they had a running commentary, but he was actively part of that until he disappeared over the English Channel. You know, we still don't know whatever happened to him in his plane crash. So well-known entertainers became involved in all of this, of course. And some of these, I'm going to show you this, and then I'll start talking about what Germany did. This is a big band, which I'm guessing most of you have not ever heard of. It's called the International Sweethearts of Rhythm. And it's an all-female band. They actually were in existence before the war. It started in, I think, Arkansas someplace. And it's really unusual for the time because it included African-American, Asian, Latina, and Native American women, as well as white, at a time when all the big bands were segregated, basically. I think Benny Goodman had integrated his band somewhat, but he was probably the only one. So these women practiced. They were really good. They used the same format as the other big bands. You can see they're all sitting behind their desks, and they have the insignia, and they're all wearing uniforms. They became prominent beginning in 1940, and they toured the U.S. and actually overseas. They went on USO tours. That's another outreach that the U.S. had, but it wasn't a government-sponsored. It was a private organization that sponsored the USO tours. They were famous. The director there in the middle is Anna Mae Wynberg, who also sang. I don't know who the soloist is here. But they were known for, they had a really, really fantastic tenor sax player named Violet Vi Burnside. And you can hear a recording on YouTube of her ripping up the solos in Sweet Georgia Brown. It's phenomenal. She was they were admired all over, and I'm just going to read a quote about them. First, of course, because they were women, they surprised a lot of people who didn't know that women could do those things. "Top musicians all, these girls don't depend upon shapely figures to put their playing across." That's just language of the time, right?
Yeah.
"They dish out the kind of music you would expect from a Basie, Goodman, or Kirk. They play like all those guys, only better." That was written by a man, by the way. And another columnist stated, "The misguided impression men have about women musicians is that they can't play. That statement makes about as much sense as Louis Armstrong trying to cross Lake Erie in a hollow tooth. The Sweethearts can match riffs with any band in the Kingdom of Swing." So, yeah, cool, and they should get more. They're in the book because Gina Bombola, who wrote that chapter, included them in her description. And of course, these are very well-known entertainers, right? Who are those women?
The
Andrews sisters. Who went, soared to fame with things like Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy and Don't Sit Under the Apple Tree with Anyone Else But Me. Those are all in films. And film is such an important element in this whole business, because of the way it could portray people. And the interesting thing is that even as the war wore on, and even towards the end, Maxine Andrews, who I think was mainly the spokesperson for the group, said, we're as upbeat, we're going to win because we're right. But I still think about all those boys and wonder, I feel bad about it. She had doubts, in other words, even the most upbeat, positive singer, which is, you know, all the music that was played stateside was really positive and can-do kind of attitude, right? Humorous. And there were songs that were not supposed to be played, like The White Cliffs of Dover, mm-hmm. or White Christmas, mm-hmm. you know? And then, of course, the other sensation, who really, the guy who came to fame in the 40s and just took off from there, was Frank Sinatra. This is an early performance of his in 1945. Yeah. Look at all of his adoring fans in the back.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right? So that style of singing is known as what?
Crooner.
Yeah. And the other great crooner at the time was?
Bing
Crosby. Sure. And in fact, there were feuds going on about who was better. And some people, apparently the servicemen overseas, the people who had grown up hearing Bing Crosby preferred him. They wanted his records sent to them. Whereas the younger crowd was more interested in Sinatra. It's a little bit of a generational thing. The thing I think about when I look at that is how skinny he was.
Yeah.
I mean, he was just a short kid from New Jersey. Right. And I do know one thing about his that I read about his singing. He really trained himself. In order to develop the breath control, you needed to sing those long lines. He practiced swimming underwater, holding his breath.
Uh-huh.
And I think it supposedly helped. So, okay. Let's talk about briefly what time is it?
Behind you.
Okay. Something that's not very well known is what the Nazis were doing. They had their own nationalistic music and everything, but they also tried, as soon as the United States entered the war, I think Goebbels and other people realized that this has really changed the balance, and this was serious, and they had to do something. So they started two programs during the war of propaganda. Oh wait, first I gotta pass this cartoon around. It's a humorous take on how music could be used as a weapon. There's a picture of trombone players. The brass goes into action. And the second one is, and just think, 1 year ago, we were playing Mozart quartets. So, slightly humorous take. That actually brings up something that I want to go to before we talk about the Germans. I'm afraid I'm going to talk too much and run out of time. Sorry. No, that's fine. As the war went on, you know, you have cartoons like this. You have, who was the, Bill Malden? Is that his name?
Yeah.
The cartoonist who wrote what the GIs were saying, what they're looking, you know, the kind of gallows humor that they had a lot of times about things. And as I said, there's a disconnect between what the soldiers were experiencing, and they tried to put a good face, and of course letters were censored from wherever they were fighting, right? But soldiers, as in every war, preceding and after, made up their own words to songs. For the soldiers of World War II, the sarcastic response to sentimentality took shape in parody. Okay, so there's all these happy, bouncy, feel-good type things being written at home, and the troops' disillusion and their ironic response in song and satire and sullen contempt came from knowing that the home front then, and very likely later historians, would be aware of none of these things. Because they weren't allowed to really write about them. But they experienced them. They experienced these emotions and had seen things that they would never forget. So one of the show tunes that was parodied was from the musical Oklahoma. Now, this came out in 1943, right? It was the first production, Rodgers and Hammerstein collaboration, and was greeted with such enthusiasm by American audiences because it was a story, not about the war, obviously, you all know it, the story of Oklahoma, right? And the truth was, the opening of Oklahoma Territory, which is the context for this musical, took place in the 1880s, and sadly, was the last remnant of Indian Territory. Mm-hmm. And then it was opened up to U.S. settlers. So that's a very dark subtext, but that's not something people knew or thought about. They were just, it was like all these white folks coming in and making a country great, and there's a song about the rancher and the cowman can be friends, right? You know, we're going to build this country together as a kind of coded language for what we're going to do. We're going to win the war and make it safe for democracy again. So there's a song in there that you probably all know, a love song between Lori and Curly. People will say we're in love, right? So here's a version of the kind of song that GI's made up, and I don't have recordings, so you're going to have to put up with me singing, but I think I'm going to turn my mic off. Don't throw grenades at me. Don't lob mob mortar shells. Don't shoot your artillery. People will say we're at war. Don't throw grenades at me. Don't pull that safety pin. Crowd buddy, don't you see? People will say I'm done in. If you don't pull that pin, Kraut buddy, because people will say I'm done in. Don't you see?
Done in.
So a total parody of the original. Don't, you know, don't look at me too much. Don't hold my hands. Don't.
Mike. Mike.
Yeah, Mike.
Right. Turn your mic on.
Oh.
If you're done.
Yeah. No, there's not another verse, so you're scared of that. I think that's a good illustration of how things were different then over there, wherever it was, whether it was the European theater or the Pacific, and how it was at home. So what were the Germans doing? Okay, so Goebbels came up with this idea called happy hour in the afternoon, which is not what we think of as happy hour. There was no alcohol involved. It was to make a series of radio broadcasts to the German public to entertain them and keep them from listening to American broadcasts. Yeah, it's a good idea, right? But the problem was Goebbels was so prejudiced against American popular music, and particularly jazz, he didn't really know how to do it very well. It was started in 1941, I think. So the audience that he was aiming at were German soldiers and German housewives. And I don't know that they would have wanted the same kind of music. So it was basically a variety show, which, you know, all those were very popular back then. So besides music, it included some dialogue and things. But the thing is that I can't understand, is I'm trying to find exactly what it was. Here we go. The program would showcase various conductors, opera singers, actors, comedians, and acrobats.
On radio?
On radio. So I have no idea how that was supposed to work. Unless they had somebody describing what the acrobats were doing while they were doing their routine.
It's all about the spin.
Yeah. There's something for everybody. You just can't see it. But of course, jazz, hot jazz, and swing music were forbidden. And that's what people wanted to hear. So that didn't really work too well. It was only on the air for, I think, 4 months from June to September. And also wasn't terribly well organized. So then it came up with another idea, which was called Station Debunk, like to debunk a myth or debunk a lie. And that was aimed at, this was a more serious purpose, aimed at the United States. It was aimed at specifically the Midwest. This program had two commentators who spoke, I guess, pretty good English. One was named Joe. And the other one was Mac or something, you know, not a German name. And they were broadcasting music, but also propaganda, and aiming it at an audience who they thought was not as sophisticated as people in New York and Washington, for example. And they were basically trying to infiltrate the United States and create a divide among the American public with their attitude towards the war. So, and previous to this time, the Nazis had really just concentrated on Britain, in a way, because that was the only real force left against them. I'm trying to find out what Station Debunk. They were trying to rekindle isolationist sentiments among this often rural population. Because remember in the 30s, America was not interested in getting involved in anything else in the world. We were basically in isolation. And there were still people who I think felt that way, at least somewhat. And so they were trying to exploit that kind of that kind of attitude.
But Sarah, not only that, there was a high concentration of German immigrants in the Midwest, right, along the Mississippi River Valley.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a huge concentration of that. I lived in Davenport, Iowa in 1968, and they had just closed the German bakery, the Germans printed language newspaper, the bank that spoke in German. So there was a high concentration. There was a target audience there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's a good, very good point. Of course, there was in Wisconsin, too, and Wisconsin. Ohio. I mean, I know I listened to a paper about German theater, speaking theater, in the early years of the 20th century. German newspapers were being published. And this was a big problem in World War I, and still a big audience. And there were all these Turnverein, you know, communities, that German community halls and things like that. So I think the Nazis were aware of that. They didn't know how to make good musical choices, but they had done their homework in terms, I think, of the populations, the demographics, like you would say. Yeah, anyway, that was what Station Debunk tried to do that, and they tried to get a group of German musicians together. They called it Charlie and his orchestra. Because they thought that sounded, you know, like something you'd hear in America.
Sure.
And they just didn't have the same thing, you know. I mean, you can't, on the one hand, denigrate jazz and discourage people from listening to it or playing it, and then try to use it as a tool.
Yeah.
Right, which is, I think, what Goebbels did. So that wasn't really a success either, but I thought it was worth mentioning because we know more about what we sent out there, but we didn't know as much about what was coming from the other side. The other aspect, of course, is what everybody knows. Axis Sally, Tokyo Rose were propagandists for the Germans and the Japanese, respectively. And I was going to say that Operation Debunk was staffed by, advised by, actually, a former U.S. Embassy employee, Dr. Herbert John Bergman, who was convicted of treason by a U.S. court after the war and died in prison. And he was given assistance by American-born Nazis, Edward V. Sittler and Charles Sittler, as well as Julius Krauss. So there were these sympathizers in every country, Britain too, obviously, right? Mm-hmm. And that was part of the whole propaganda thing and trying to undermine. Axis Sally was named Mildred something. I don't know if I can find her name. But the thing with her, and maybe with Tokyo Rose, is, well, they played good music. But while the soldiers were savvy, they knew about this. They listened to the music, but they would discount the propaganda because they did was not good, right? There was a big difference. So it wasn't sophisticated enough to really achieve anything. Okay, one other footnote. This is, again, part of the war effort and propaganda as well. These are, I'll pass this around, these are not very good reproductions, but musical instrument companies in this country, which produced especially brass instruments, signed on to stop, they stopped making instruments for a while so that the metal could be used for weapons, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And so this is the Elkhart Band Instrument Company from Elkhart, Indiana, has this ad called, "Here's Information Wanted by the Enemy." And it's all about not talking about things that, because, you know, loose lips sink ships, that kind of idea. Button it up for the duration. If you know something, keep it off the air. And if you're simply busting with information, why, just get out that sweet, sweet Elkhart horn and rip off a little private jam session of your own. It's mighty relieving. And then this other company that also made brass instruments is now working with airplanes, and the Kahn Instrument Company, which is still very much in business, also was helping make navigating instruments for airplanes. Mm. They turned to the production of those as opposed to just making instruments. So I'll pass this around in case you want to see, but this was something I had not heard of until I started looking into this whole subject. So the question, I guess, I have is, like I said, this war was pretty clear-cut in terms of the bad guys and the good guys for most people. And we've all been to memorial services, and you know, we have Memorial Day every year, there are monuments, and there's music that's been written to commemorate. And the thing I've been thinking about is like, what's the difference between patriotism and nationalism? Mm-hmm. And how does music fit into that? So I welcome your thoughts on that. And also, how do we remember and how do we commemorate and respect the sacrifices that were made by people who gave their lives, who died, who were killed, who were wounded, sometimes permanently. They lived, but they were damaged. How do we respect that and honor that without glorifying war and stirring up the emotions that will lead to another conflict? We'll start this whole cycle over again. I don't have any answers, but I would welcome your thoughts. And I think it's important to think about those things, because sometimes certain political factions will kind of hijack feelings of patriotism, right? It's like, and especially that's happened, I think, during the Vietnam era. But anyway, do you have any?
During the Gulf War happened, I can remember I was getting ready for church one day, and Robert Schuller had a program on, and it was right at the beginning of the Gulf War, and he had this gigantic American flag, and they had all of these yellow ribbons, and they had all of this stuff. And I remember thinking, do we just not learn anything? You know, it's very recent. This stuff is more recent. It's not just Vietnam 50 years ago. It's more recent than that. We're in war. We have been in a war since 2003. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't seem to touch us. It's a constant thing. We're still there. We're still doing it.
So how does propaganda work on the effect? I mean, like you say, he's using symbolism. Symbolism's a big deal he puts in any kind of propaganda, right? Mm-hmm. But why bring it in? Why bring God into it? Religion. It's another
bless
thing.
Bless it.
Makes us right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we kind of touched on this with the Civil War discussion on Monday. That God's on our side, and we are morally righteous, and we have the upper hand, and we're justified in doing things. So that happens in other places too, of course. But
I think we need to remember Lincoln's response to God's on our side. That was at a cabinet meeting, apparently. One of his cabinet members said that. Mm-hmm. He said, no, we need to be concerned that we're on God's side. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, nobody questioned whether God actually wants people to have wars. Okay. What about the patriotism nationalism thing? Any thoughts on Alexa?
Well, and I think this kind of is a jumping off point of what people have been saying. Because I see the difference between the two. Is that nationalistic music talks about qualities of the country itself. So it talks about the landscape. It involves usually folk music, you know, music that is, you know, born of the people of that country. Whereas patriotistic music tends to be more, yay, us, we are awesome. And it doesn't necessarily have to do with sort of the inherent nature of the country itself, but is a little more propagandistic in its character.
Right.
And, you know, so the example of God Bless America, which, you know, yes, we want God to bless us, but it sort of has a little bit of that tinge of God is on our side, not we are on God's side kind of idea.
Okay. So nationalism is more about defining a population as kind of a tribe sometimes?
So, like, for example, you could use Copeland's Appalachian Spring as an example of nationalistic music, because that's more born out of folk music and you know, American life.
Americana.
Yes.
Yeah. That calls on a heritage then.
Right.
Which we want it to be a common heritage, although different kinds of different populations will be excluded from that. Mm-hmm. Right? Sure. Okay.
But hasn't the word sort of lately taken on a different spin? To say someone's nationalistic is not
a good thing.
Right.
It's not a good thing.
No, well, and that's where we are right now is that, you know, looking at in our country, but also in other countries in Europe, like Hungary, Italy.
Hungary, right now.
We have these leaders, Orban and in Hungary and Salvini in Italy, and then can't remember the guy in Poland. But he's kind of wants to move that way. And then, you know, there was Chavez in Venezuela. It was very, and then they're called populists as part of nationalism now, maybe, but it's not conducive to world peace. It's certainly not conducive. What it does, I think, is excludes
isolationist
people. Yeah, and it's a very aggressive kind of sentiment, which, you know, and we know from history that kind of aggression leads to war, generally. Look at World War I, right?
I always kind of look at nationalism as a view outward. You know, you're looking at the country as opposed to the rest of the world in sort of a sum zero game.
Mm.
You know, we got to get ours. And
yeah.
Patriotism is more of an internal look.
Mm.
That, you know, here we are, you know, the good ship USA, and time to stand up for us, you know, so,
yeah.
You know, which direction you're looking.
That's interesting, where you put it.
Before 9/11, the national anthem was not people stand, it said do anything. After 9/11, we have the giant American flags, similar to what Hitler used in World War II, at stadiums and proclamations, and you don't dare sit during the national anthem, as we've seen in the National Football League in the last 5 years.
And that was government action that made that possible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's interesting, though, is we're season ticket holders for Quadzity Symphony and the Davenport Rock Island, and they do concerts both sides of the river every weekend, but they're doing performances. And for back to World War II, I think, and when the bombing of Pearl Harbor, they sang the Star Spangled Banner to begin the concert.
Hmm.
And now we always stand and sing the Star Spangled Banner before the concert. And one year they decided not to do it, and there was such an uproar on those Midwest folks. And we still do the Star Spangled Banner before every concert. And I think that's interesting.
Well, that gets to be, that means something's being imposed on people, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's a control issue, right? And I do think that's one of the goals of propaganda, is to try to make everybody walk the same walk and believe the same thing. Yeah.
One of the things is that around singing, I think what you're talking about, the truth to sing, and that the power of singing and the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And in our country, there's no place where we do that anymore, except in church.
Mm-hmm.
You know, generally, at least in our part of the world, in the West Coast, kids don't go to sing in school, you know, so there's not any group singing. Some of my colleagues used to sort of get it. I used to, when I was a professor, on, Memorial Day weekend and July 4th, and Labor Day, stuff like that, before we even started the service, we'd sing is My Country 'Tis of Thee, because the words are very good,
mm-hmm.
You know. And the only reason I did it, not necessarily to have national songs in church, but because there was no place else people could gather to sing, to remember on those national holidays.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I want to piggyback on what Chris said. The note, I believe, in the Quad City Symphony program says, they sing that to remember the fallen. It's not for national pride, it's to remember the fallen. And therefore, the audience is requested not to applaud after the plane.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you go to a basketball game, everybody's yelling,
yeah.
Applauding. But they specifically said, please don't, because we're remembering the fallen.
That's interesting. I haven't heard that one before. Is it possible to love? I mean, this obviously the root of this word is pater, right, the Latin word for father, patriotism, patriarchy, same roots. Is it possible to love your country, but not be nationalistic?
Yes.
That's that's what I would like to have. Where I'm growing up, my generation, I mean, with Vietnam going on, it was like you couldn't say that you loved America without being branded a total, I don't know, a toady of the political, industrial, military complex or something. But I mean, this, and I like the idea that this is talking about some, an outward-looking thing, like trying to separate your country and highlight things that make you your country unique, as opposed to simply loving about it. This just, but this doesn't, doesn't need to exclude people. It could be anybody who lives here and is a citizen could can feel a part of it. However, of course, you know, historically there are groups who have been deliberately excluded. You know, we've got racism and we've got prejudice against religions and things like that. But I guess in an ideal world, I'm saying.
Well, if you don't have a burqa.
What?
If you don't wear a burqa.
If you don't wear a burqa, yeah. Well, there were days, of course, when you couldn't be a Jew and get anywhere either.
Or you couldn't be a woman.
Or a woman, yeah.
It's been...
Or Irish.
Yeah. Yeah, you can go way back. You know, every group of immigrants that comes over has been met with prejudice and restrictions.
Well, at least what I'm hearing from a portion of our government, including for certain our president, nationalism takes on a negative tone instead. We're all talking about it very positive, thinking about our country and the good things about our country, but if you become nationalistic to the point of you ignore the rest of the world and you're not going to be a participant of our country with other countries, then that's the negative side of nationalism.
Yeah. Check.
Professor, the question I have is about the paper, that green paper we have in our wallets, our pockets, we carry around. Every time you look at it, there's the greatest piece of propaganda you could ever see. You know, Jesus said, you know, render unto Caesar what Caesar, the God was God. No. The piece of paper, it says, in God we trust. And so you've subsumed the two into nationalism and what you worship is the nation.
Hmm. And we did the same thing with the Pledge of Allegiance when they inserted
under God.
Under God.
Yeah.
Which I go silent at that point.
Oh, okay, good.
She has a comment here.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I was just so politicized.
We are? Yes.
Yeah, I mean, all of this.
Well, and so that gets back to propaganda. I don't know how music is, the spoken word is probably more active than patriotism, but if you do think about 9/11, and there's a chapter in the book that a Canadian scholar wrote, really analyzing the music, what happened musically after 9/11 was radios, again, where radio stations were told not to play certain groups.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, you all know what happened to Dixie Chicks.
Yeah,
just for making a comment like, we're embarrassed that our president's from Texas. We got death threats from
them.
Mm-hmm. The propaganda is, I mean, it's a force. And what's kind of interesting to me is how complex it was in World War II, because it was supposed to be positive and build morale and provide a solace for people and a comfort kind of thing, but also was used as a weapon. Mm-hmm. So music is dangerous, can be dangerous. And art can too, visual art. If you can find all kinds of posters from different wars, but they're horrific from World War I. You know, they've got the Kaiser painted as a gorilla with blood coming out of his mouth, you know, his bloodthirsty thing, and holding a victim in his hand. I mean, you know, so it all gets very complicated, but I think as long as we're aware of it, and one thing I was going to say is that composers really struggle to portray things honestly without descending into just propaganda, I think, or trying to avoid cliches. This is something that artists have to struggle with. We have just a few minutes, so let me just play. I think you're all probably familiar with Ken Burns' documentary on World War II. Probably on a down note, but on the other hand, this American anthem that Bill Charlap wrote and Nora Jones sings it.
This is great.
It's really reflective, and I think. Thank you.
you.
Thank you.